The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the fifth and final day of this five-day elder sesshin here at Mountain Gate. And we are going to share a little bit more of Tony Packer's writings, again from her book, The Wonder of Presence and the Way of Meditative Inquiry. And we're going to start with this, which is something to ponder. The concept of beginning and ending is time produced by thought. In other words, the only time there is, really, the only time there is right here now. But the idea of breaking right here now into segments and conceiving of a past and a future as well as the present is all in the realm of ideas, all story. We spoke yesterday about how there's a phenomenon that many people experience when they are under the kind of intense stress demanding utter attention, as in, for example, a car accident, where time seems to stand still or certainly go in slow motion. And it's a very interesting phenomena, but it comes about because people are so totally present that there's nobody being present. There is just the occurrence. There is just the being. And the time impression is simply that. It's an impression. It's an idea. It's not a reality. Can we see right now that beginning and end, getting someplace, which comes with our ideas of time, being somebody, wanting to get something I lack, are all products of the imagination. We don't normally experience life like this. Normally there's a center that we assume we are the center of, and we feel totally solid. Feels like we've got attributes and problem places. It feels like we are lacking certain things and may have some other things that are advantageous, talents or whatever. But all of it is just a bag of ideas. Who we are. Who is that? Really. When people have near-death experiences, they're changed. They see life differently after that. Did they become two different people? The before person and the after person? Or were both a set of concepts, stories, ideas? As long as this isn't clear, this body-mind remains tied up in knots. Can we see that thinking about tomorrow or about what is planned for dinner tonight is all conceptualization? We can think about food when there's actually no food in front of us. Tonight, quote-unquote, is a thought. Dinner, quote-unquote, is a thought. The future, quote-unquote, in which I will be enlightened, is a thought. Can we see it instantly? Can we see that a thought is always away from this present moment where time does not exist? When the food is right in front of us, are we just eating? Or are we thinking about wanting more? And then she talks about stages. There are various different teachings, even within Buddhism, that talk about stages. In fact, particularly in the Theravadin way of teaching, way of seeing things, but also the ancient Indian, as an East Indian, as in the time of the Buddha, or following the time of the Buddha, the Indians love to categorize things. They love to put numbers to things, and that's why you have however many gazillion bodhisattva mahasattvas filling this little teeny room that Vimalakirti is lying in bed in, and somehow they're all able to get in that room. And it probably stemmed from that Indian way of conceptualizing things, that they talk about the 10 stages of bodhisattva development. There's a koan that reads, a woman was sitting next to the Buddha in deep samadhi. And Manjushri, who's the bodhisattva of wisdom, and in essence the most developed bodhisattva, says to the Buddha, "What's she doing there?" And he says, "Well, why don't you wake her up and ask her yourself? Wake her out of her samadhi. She's not asleep. She's just totally absorbed in inner contemplation." And so Manjushri walks around her and snaps his fingers and does all kinds of things and tries to wake her up, and she's still deep in samadhi. And so the Buddha says, "Well, why don't you call such and such bodhisattva from the lower realms? See if he can't waken her." And the bodhisattva that was called was one of the earlier stage bodhisattvas, one who was not a highly developed bodhisattva. And he instantly was able to wake the woman. And this is actually, this koan has a very deep, deep meaning. Far away from men, women, high, low, any of that. So don't think about those ideas with regard to this koan, because they're completely irrelevant. But nonetheless, if you look at the traditional teachings, which of course weren't written down until well after the Buddha died, 200 years, I think, after the Buddha died, it was possible to write them down. And till that time, they were carried in memory. And then there was the great Buddhist university at Nalanda, where monks studied and learned doctrine that by that point, I think they probably called it something equivalent to doctrine, learned the teachings. And things began to be categorized, which of course is not within really the teaching in a sense. On the other hand, we can see it as skillful means. So what is time? When we think about, you know, here Sesshin is about to end and I didn't accomplish, or I did accomplish, what I intended to. All of that is ideas. Where's the me to accomplish or not accomplish? Where's the me to succeed or fail? Find that one, or I should say try to find that one, and don't just automatically assume it doesn't exist. Go for it. Try to find some concrete evidence that I exist. You can't point to the body. Are you identical to the moment you were born? That body went through lots of changes. What is the essence of that body? What is the essence that inhabits that body, makes it move, talk, see, think? Where did we come from? Or did we come from somewhere? Normally we don't think about these things, but it's worth pondering, searching for answers. Searching for understanding is really a better word. Answers imply words, but the answers that come through understanding have nothing to do with words. In fact, it's very difficult to put them into words, even as strongly and deeply as you recognize the truth. So she's talking about stages. Here in the work of this moment, we're not trying to mold ourselves to a preconceived path or stages. Teachings that postulate stages grab the thinking mind. We wonder what these stages are like, and trying to figure them out is an exercise in headaches. And of course, the main interest is, what stage am I in? How many more will I have to go through? When will I come to awakening? And then the grand assumption that it's a total, complete change, and never before do we go back into delusion. Awakening is like turning a light on. And then we can see the cobwebs. And then we can see the rotten fruit in the corner. And then we can see the dirt on the floor and the rest of it. And then it's up to us to clean that stuff up, clean it out, so that there is nothing interfering. And yet, it's not about getting rid of anything. How can we fathom that? We look at ourselves, we look at other people, we look at our lives, we look at the lives of other people, and we see places where they could improve, or places where they're dysfunctional and should definitely improve, or places where they're outstanding. And yet, the whole thing is perfect as it is. This is something that is greatly misunderstood. Can we drop the idea of stages and not pick it up again, even though it's prevalent in many traditions? Can we see and feel that any such conceptualization is already a straitjacket? Thought is so powerful. Thinking what I am now, what I will be next, judging myself about what I think I am and what I could be, the power of such thoughts cannot be overestimated. They prevent a presence and awareness that defies all definition. And then we're going to jump to chapter 8, which is entitled, What is the Me? A summer day, isn't it? This sounds like yesterday. Dark, cloudy, cool, moist, and windy. Amazing, this whole affair of the weather. We call it weather, but what is it really? Wind? Rain? Clouds slowly parting? Not the words spoken about it, but just this darkening, blowing, pounding, wetting, and then lightening up, blue sky appearing amid darkness and sunshine sparkling on wet grasses and leaves. In a little while, there will be frost, snow, and ice covers, and then warming again, melting, oozing water everywhere. On an early spring day, the dirt road sparkles with streams of wet silver. So, what is weather other than this incessant change of earthly conditions and all the human thoughts, feelings, and undertakings influenced by it? Like and dislike, depression and elation, creation and destruction, an ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. And here's a clue. An ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. And yet we take it to be solid, fixed, permanent. And when it shows itself as not permanent, we get dismayed. Try to grab it back. Or if it's permanent, we think, and we don't like it, and we try to get rid of it. All of this is story. All of this is ideas. What's the reality? Who are we really? It's as if this ability to think has gotten so far out of control. Like the sorcerer's apprentice with that broom and that bucket. Never ceasing, creating turbulence. An ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. No real entity, whether, quote-unquote, exists anywhere except in thinking and talking about it. Now, is there such an entity as me or I? Or is it just like the weather, an ongoing, ever-changing stream of ideas, images, memories, projections, likes and dislikes, creation and destruction that thought keeps calling I, me, Tony, and thereby solidifying what is evanescence, or seemingly solidifying what is evanescent? What am I really, truly, and what do I merely think and believe I am? Are we interested in exploring this amazing affair of myself from moment to moment? Is this maybe the essence of this work? Many, many years ago in Rochester, it was very easy to see going around in Keeneheen that one of my Dharma brothers there living at the Rochester Zen Center was deeply absorbed. His body went around in Keeneheen. His body sat on the cushion. His mind was deeply curious. And he had a kensho in that sesshin. And afterwards he said, why didn't somebody tell me it's just about exploring your own mind? It's just about exploring your own mind. Chisan at Sogenji is said that the Zendo was really a laboratory for discovering, learning, exploring. It's not about me sitting on the cushion trying to find this ideal me that is enlightened. Enlightenment is here all the time. It's just this idea that we're a solid being. Fixed, that prevents that from happening. And it also straitjackets us, because if we think we are somebody with certain characteristics and certain abilities and certain likes and dislikes, then we get ourselves into situations and we're forced to behave out of that straitjacket, which is extraordinarily narrowing. And we wonder why we don't feel free. There you have it. Most human beings take it for granted that I am me, and that me is this body, this mind, this knowledge and sense of myself that feels so obviously distinct and separate from other people and from the nature around us. The language in which we talk to ourselves and to each other inevitably implies separate me's and you's all the time. It's very interesting that in Japan, the Japanese language, these personal pronouns are rarely used. Rarely used. You don't go around saying, I want this, or I think that, or I'm going there, or I just came back from here. You come back into the house and you say itekimasu, which means arrived. You go out with somebody, or you're about to go out with somebody, or getting your coats on, you say ikimashou ka, means shall go. And of course in English, in order to translate it, we have to say shall we go, but there's no we in that word. Burmese, the same. And in Burmese, it's interesting, there's not even a past or a present or a present or a future tense. There's only the present tense. But in English and in the Romance languages and in other languages in the world, in our so-called high-level cultures, there's an awful lot of I, me, you, them, and it breeds division. Where there is none. All of us talk, I and you talk. We think it, write it, read it, and dream it with rarely any pause. There's incessant reinforcement of the sense of me, separate from others, isolated, insulated me, not understood by others. How are we to come upon the truth if separateness is taken so much for granted and feels so common sense? The difficulty's not insurmountable. Wholeness, our true being, is here all the time. Like the sun behind the clouds, light is here in spite of cloud cover. What makes up the clouds? Can we begin to realize that we live in conceptual, abstract ideas about ourselves? That we are rarely in touch directly with what actually is going on, and we don't even realize that? Can we realize that thoughts about myself, I'm good or I'm bad, I'm liked or disliked, are nothing but thoughts? And the thoughts do not tell us the truth about what we really are or the truth about what anybody else is. A thought is a thought, and it triggers instant physical reactions, pleasures, and pains throughout the body-mind. Physical reactions generate further thoughts and feelings about myself. I'm suffering. I'm happy. I'm not as bright or as good-looking as the others. That feedback implies that all this is me, that I've gotten hurt or feel good about myself or that I need to defend myself or get more approval and love from others. When we're protecting ourselves in our daily relationships, we're not protecting ourselves from flying stones or bomb attacks. It's from words we're taking cover, from gestures, from coloration of voice and innuendo. We're protecting ourselves, we're taking cover, and using our